Screw it. Here we go.
Privacy is so important. And the more you give it away, the more, you know, convenience is not why you should ever give something away. It is private, your privacy, right? Because you are exposing yourself. So for me, this simple is I just don't want my information to be connected to my Bitcoin purchases that can be exploited in any way.
Hey, everybody. This is the High Hash Rate Podcast. I'm Mike.
And I'm Dan.
And this podcast is just two plebs getting high and talking about Bitcoin, life, and the absurdity of the fiat world. Our guests don't necessarily get high with us, and you don't have to either.
But it helps.
Welcome back to High Hash Rate. Today, we're talking to Grafton. Grafton is from Vexel. He's the head of growth. Grafton, how you doing? Tell us a little bit about Vexel and what that is.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for having me, you guys. So Vexel is a mobile app that's peer-to-peer, allows you to buy Bitcoin without KYC, purely peer-to-peer. So we're kind of different than everybody else in the sense that we don't have a rating system. We don't rate users or offers. Everything is based on your network, your web of trust, essentially. So your social graph. So you only ever trade with friends and friends of friends, basically. So that's kind of what we built. And now it's available everywhere in the world, pretty much, except one country.
Which country is that?
Unfortunately, that's the United States of America.
Come on. Is it because of the tariffs?
No, not because of the tariffs, just because, well, the previous administration maybe was interesting. I don't know. We'll see where it goes. But yeah, we didn't want to kind of get stopped before we even got started.
So, sure. And how did you get started, or how did you end up at Vexel? So that is, let's see, you're in the Czech Republic. Is that correct?
Yes,
Czech Republic. And you sound like you're from... I used to live in Biloxi, Mississippi, so you sound like one of the people there. How did you end up in Europe, and what's your background, and where does who kind of launched Vexel?
Yeah, so the one thing I've held on to in all these years is my southern draw, my southern accent. I am originally from Mississippi, but I went to university out in Texas and did a study abroad in the UK. So I did a semester over there, and then came to Prague for a 4-day weekend and met some friends here that were just cool as shit. And we kept in touch. And when I graduated from university, I was like, all right, you know what? I'll do 1 year. I had a teaching degree to teach history and political science. And this part of the world always fascinated me, a post-communist country. We're Americans. We take it for granted, freedom, but this part of the world was always interesting. So I decided I'd do 1 year. I kept in touch with them and was going to teach English. And then you blink and it's 14 years later. And this is where I feel like I grew up. I came over here, couldn't grow a beard, none of that good stuff. And then, I feel like I grew up here. So my closest friends are all Czech now. This is where my life is. You can probably see my dog on the sofa behind me. I'm pretty entrenched.
What is the Eastern European version of the Chattahoochee?
Probably the Vltava. Yeah. In Czech Republic, you can go down south, to Český Krumlov. You get on the rafts and, you float the river all day.
Yeah. So what, that's culture. It's a big culture shock. I mean, all right, it seems like it would be, Mississippi to Eastern Europe. And it sounds like you fit in right away, which, I think a lot of people, and you talk about the differences in freedom, liberty, culture, all that stuff. Everything's got its own flavor, but it's not it's not a one-to-one comparison, right? It's not this place is free, this place isn't free. Can you talk a little bit about that cultural adjustment and the different types of freedom vibes or lack thereof that you kind of had to get used to?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Americans are very friendly. You're standing in line somewhere and, people start up a conversation with you, you've known them, or they'll tell you your whole life story. And that's something that, has kind of been assimilated out of me, I would say. You know, like, I'm not, like, I, when I stand in line somewhere, I'm not chatting up random Czech people, you know. Like, you know, you go to the post office in America and you're waiting in line and all of a sudden you have five new friends. Like, that is an adjustment. But when I think about, like, freedom in a way, in a sense, it's kind of like, you know, the further you get away from obtaining your freedom, the more you, like, you forget what it's like to have it. And I think, you know, in communism in the Czech Republic, you know, like, everyone was kind of considered a narc. You know, you tell on your neighbor because it might increase your social status, right? And this was something that, you know, when the fall of communism happened, something like that, really, people were like, yeah, don't bother me, I won't bother you. And so that kind of sense of freedom is like, the, as long as I don't annoy someone else or harm someone or do something like that, people just kind of leave you alone. Also, you know, you can really feel it in the government as well. It's like, we, you know, you have these still these leaders that have been kind of memories of the past, but most of the people here are kind of like fed up with the government. You know, like, this is a place where you have like the Paralleni Polis, which was the parallel society that I'm sure you know is, it was part of the crypto anarchist movement and these kinds of things. So you look here and you also can feel it in the people. And you know, look at some of the projects that have come out of Czech Republic. I mean, you have like Trezor, the hardware wallets, you have you know, Slush Pool, you have, you know, some very cool things that have been here as a result of that kind of post-communist spark. And so I think you do have a lot of people, when you think about like the culture, that understand, you know, like, I grew up in Mississippi, a pretty conservative place, you know, gun loving, hunting, fishing, and, you know, I love Jesus, hunting and fishing in that order, my kids and, you know, stuff like that. But the traditional family here is also much stronger. And I would say, like, the one thing that was kind of a big adjustment is, coming from Mississippi, where everyone is evangelical Christian, and coming to a country where, you know, the majority of the population is atheist, right? Like, God is not in the conversation here.
And, right, that's communism, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, I mean, but it's interesting because,
places.
Like... Yeah, but it's like...
That's by default? Like, no one is really...
Well, that's part everyone... of it. Is anti, it's like they stamp out religions, you know, they stamp out any sort of, I mean,
is it,
the
is
people
it almost,
this, but they stamp out, like, they don't, like, want families, communities, they want people to be, you know, reliant on the
loyal,
state and the,
yeah, is it
loyal
like a taboo to talk about, is it a taboo to talk about religion or God, or it's just like bad manners?
I mean, people here, it's not bad manners to talk about religion because most people will just laugh in your face. Like, you know, like, one day I met some Mormon, you know, missionaries at the tram stop, and, you know, they spoke like perfect Czech language. And I was like, you know, I could tell they were American. I was like, are you guys from Utah? You know, they're like, how the hell did you know? I'm like, you know, it's pretty obvious where you're from. But I was like, you must have it so difficult here. And they're like, man, you have no idea. You know, you knock on someone's door, you try to approach someone, and everybody just kind of laughs at us. They treat us really nicely. Czech people are kind, you know, but when it comes to religion, they're just like, really, I have other things to worry about. But that's not just as a result of communism, right? Because if you look at Poland, if you look at Slovakia, these countries held on to religion. They're still quite conservative and religious. But Czech Republic, just something about it, people said, you know what, we have each other, let's look out for, you know, each other, be kind, be good. I mean, of course, the society is founded on Christian values, but just the absence of religion is what's kind of not here anymore. So that's an adjustment, you know, is
what, yeah, yeah. When did you get orange pill? Like, when did you find Bitcoin? Like, what was that journey like? Was that in Europe or did you find it before?
I was in the States, yeah. Like, I have a, you know, I grew up going to see shows, man. I've seen Widespread Panic like 130 something times. I've seen, you know,
hell yeah,
Disco Biscuits, Billy String. Even now, I got a Billy Strings poster on my wall. And music was the catalyst for me to get into like the community aspect of trading, you know, is like, we taped shows and then we traded them peer to peer, right?
Or you go to a show and there's like Shakedown Street, which is like, you know, you're slinging t-shirts out of the back of your car to pay for money, to get money for the next show, right? And as, you know, the forming of the internet kind of happened, there was this music online trading, and there was websites that were supported through donations, supported through torrents and these kinds of things. And, you know, I had a really good friend of mine that we go see shows with. And one day he told me about Bitcoin. I mean, I can't even like remember the exact year or whenever, but this is like, feels like forever ago. I mean, I was a decade. And he told me that he was mining Litecoin to buy Bitcoin. And this was like, because Bitcoin was too expensive to mine at the time, which was like, this is insane. You know, as if you look at it now, it was more like, it was easier to mine Litecoin than it was Bitcoin in, you know, 2013 or, you know, 2012 or something. And so I, of course, I like was paying a little bit of attention to it. You know, buying, selling, you know, is, if I had held every coin I'd ever bought, I probably wouldn't be sitting right here, you know? But it wasn't until I would say, like I got really heavily orange pilled again in 2015, upon coming back to the Czech Republic. So I took 1 year off and lived in Korea for a year. In 2014. And then when I came back to Czech Republic, I lived in the same neighborhood as Paralelny Polis. So it was like, oh, it's back on my mind. And then you start talking to people, meeting people in the cafe. And then I worked at this company called Alza, which is like the Amazon.com of Czech Republic. And I taught English to their employees. And every single one of them I taught about Bitcoin. And then they became the largest retailer, I think, in the world at the time to accept Bitcoin. Because I was teaching like the C-level people. So yeah, that's kind of like how my journey got into actually working in the industry as well, is 2020 came along, sitting at home, getting paid, but bored out of my mind. And a job advert popped up for technical support at Trezor. And I was like, nah, no way they're going to hire me. After one interview, yeah, they were like, dude, we need you. So I super glad to get into Trezor. Yeah.
So did you transition to some sort of like software engineer or like a
he's had no. A growth, he's marketing.
Yeah. So I talk to people, not machines, right? So a good buddy of mine, John Gold, which is a pseudonym, of course, told me that. And I've used it ever since. But no, I started support.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of crazy if you think about it, that most of, and you probably are keenly aware of this, probably not necessarily your job specifically, but a lot of internet marketers, digital marketing people, they're writing content, they're creating content, and they're really doing that for like the Google algorithm and like these in AI now. Like they're writing content for machines, not necessarily, or at least not totally for other people to read. It's kind of like to get indexed. But before we get off the topic really quick of the jam bands and the music, so like our last episode that we published, the guy, you know, his story began with getting arrested for having LSD. Yeah, Michael Parenti. Grateful Dead show. And then, you know, our buddy Fundamentals from the Rock Paper Bitcoin podcast, he's probably freaking out right now when he's listening to this in the future, hoping that I mention Fish because he's a huge Fish fan. And he's got his Bitcoin podcast. He's got like a math cryptography podcast. And now he's got, it's called Back on Chain. It's a Fish and Bitcoin like podcast. So it's, if anybody out there likes this stuff, check that out. But I wanted to ask, you've seen Widespread Panic so many times. What is your favorite song? Is it Chilly Water? That's mine. Okay.
No, I, man, of all the stuff, of all the years, you know, I listen to so much now of like Disco Biscuits, but I always go back to like Oak Mountain shows from 2002. But I would say my favorite Panic song would be Hatfield.
Hatfield, okay. When you go to shows, do you go to, Are you on the school side or do you go to the other side of the stage?
Yeah, for sure. School side.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not Jimmy Hearing, I respect you, but you're not Michael Houser. And I still, when I listen to Panic, I don't listen to much Jimmy Panic. I listen to Houser Panic still. Yeah.
Hell yeah. What are your thoughts on, do you like String Cheese?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen String Cheese a couple of times, but I mean,
I love Panic. I see Panic whenever I have the opportunity, but I've got friends and most of them from the South, like that's their band. And mine, like one of the first big shows, I saw String Cheese and I've seen them at Red Rocks a bunch of times. So, but I get it. I get the space for sure. But
I listen to so much of like the Disco Biscuits now though. I mean, like that's probably my main band now, which has just become that because they have really turned it up in recent years.
Do you go to Camp Bisco?
No, I've never been to Camp Bisco. I went to Iceland 2 years ago now for like 3 nights of biscuits in Iceland, which was one of the best trips of my life. That was amazing.
Yeah, that's incredible.
How have your travels affected your music taste? Because you said you spent some time in Korea and Czech Republic.
Yeah, you like K-pop?
No. No, I mean, I've basically, my friends, they all make fun of me because like, you know, they're like, play some music. And I'm like, trust me, you don't want me to play music because I basically listen to the same 5 bands on repeat that I have my whole life.
And the songs are 20 minutes long.
Yeah. 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 So, I mean, of course I love lots of music. I was a radio DJ back in high school, actually.
Okay.
And, you know, classic rock radio. So, of course, I love, like, classic rock, you know, this kind of stuff. But when I'm alone, and I call myself a live music maxi. Like, I very rarely listen to any studio albums or anything. Everything is live. So, I like because it's, you know, it's different. Every time you chase something different.
Hell yeah.
So, the Czech music or Korean music hasn't really, you know, invaded into your...
Okay. There's some good Czech songs.
Have you ever heard any of the...
Yeah. There's some good Czech music, but it's not like in my headphones. No, no.
When I was in the military, we'd be in the deployment zone, and for like I don't know why I never got the reason why, but the TV or like you know, they had like their own version of cable AFN. Television, but it was AFN. And it had like a channel that was very similar to MTV, but it was all Eastern European, so it was like Eastern European MTV. And it was very, this was like kind of before house music and bass or dubstep and stuff got popular in the US, but it was not great. It was not great.
No. I mean,
it was fun, but like not in an ironic way.
If I go to Austria for like skiing or something, I mean, yeah, I'm gonna listen to a lot of Schlager with my friends, you know, like that's something that at first I was like, this is the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. You know, it's like I can't think of something more white than German Schlager music on a ski slope of like drunk German people singing Schlager music. It's hilarious.
Is that yodeling? Is that where yodeling
it's
comes
not,
from?
Well, I mean, it's not yodeling. It's just like, I don't know. You have to look up Schlager. If you've ever been skiing in Austria, like it is, there's no après ski in the world probably better than Austrian après ski. So watching when the sun starts going down and watching all the people ski down the mountain is a very funny thing because I've never seen people, they should not be skiing, you know.
You've been in Bitcoin for quite a while and you've been in Europe, you know, most of this time. And you said you worked with Trezor and that was your first gig. So Trezor, for those people who don't know, is like really the first commercial viable hardware wallet solution that kind of came out, what was like 2012 or 13?
2013.
And honestly, there's a lot of, you know, hardware wallets come in and out of vogue and people like go have like what's fashionable to like. But, you know, Trezor is, it's been around the longest. It's never been really compromised. It's security. It's great. But one thing I've noticed is maybe this is just a vibe thing. It's not factually correct, but most of like the good big like wallet companies, they're either in Europe, Canada, there's some in the United States for sure. But what
foundation,
maybe you kind of talked about this a little bit because of like the Eastern or the European culture, the closeness to communism, the economic differences, the freedom differences, but what is your, in your experience, why the wallets coming out of Europe and not the US? even though the U.S. is, you know, a bigger economy. And like, what's the, what's been going on in that space over the time you worked in it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because if you look at kind of like one of the reasons why Trezor was created was, you know, Slush had Slush Pool. I don't know if you're familiar with Slush Pool. It was the world's first mining pool, and now it's called Brains Pool. And, you know, Slush Pool had a problem. And so, you know, there was a reaction. And part of that reaction was we have to figure out how we can make this more secure and easier for people. And when I look at like all the hardware industry in general, if I look at why Trezor exists, Trezor existed as to create a solution to a problem, not to milk people for money, right? It was crowdfunded from the beginning. Trezor has never taken a dime from a VC. Satoshi Labs, no VCs. Trezor was created because it wanted to make something convenient and accessible to make Bitcoin security easier for everyone, right? So Trezor didn't just invent the hardware wallet. They also gave us BIP39. So the reason why we have 12 or 24 words is because of Trezor, because of Stick and Slush, Moderic and Bavol, as I, you know, I know them. But this was kind of, you know, as a result of a problem. Is, I don't know if you remember, Bitcoin back in the day was not easy to keep secure on your own. You know, I think, well, who's the guy that's still looking for a hard drive in a, you know, a landfill somewhere? We hear that story all the time.
Right. Like, didn't a lot of people just like they had, they would send, you know, to a different private or address and they have like a, they had to manage like the private keys for all their addresses and like, they had to keep track of like a, it was, that's a nightmare. Like we talk about getting, it's difficult to get people to look into and take self-custody seriously because it's like, I got to remember 24 words and it's like, well, yeah, it's a lot better than it was.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and that brings me into like kind of, well, how did I get into Vexel? Right. Is, you know, with Trezor, I started as technical support. So you have a problem, I will help you or I will teach you through email how to fix it. And then that turned into me moving into like the technical writing. So then I started writing all of the manuals and the, you know, the knowledge base on the website was, I had a hand in creating for Trezor. And then, like that led me to the creation of the like Trezor expert team. So I was like the head of customer success and the Trezor expert. We launched that, which was basically onboarding for newbies into Trezor, right? Is like, I bought a hardware wallet for my 70-year-old dad. I love my dad, but I do not have the patience to help him set it up and put those things in his head. Like, you have to keep this safe, right? My dad doesn't listen to me, but a stranger, he'll listen to a stranger. And this is like a problem you see in America constantly is like why old people answer the phone and will give away $25,000 to a nice person on the phone, but their family will, you know, never get anything from them. And that is, you know, such a weird thing, but we created this. But Trezor, I was working at Trezor. I love the hardware wallet, but Bitcoin was my, you know, my biggest interest. You know, I had my shitcoin days where I was playing around where it didn't matter what shitcoin you bought. You throw a dart at a board and you go, hey, that's fun. But then, you know, you learn that that's casino gambling and that has no effect on, you know, anything that I have interest in, and Bitcoin became my main focus. So in Miami in 2022, I met Leia, who is our CEO of Vexel. And she is a like a powerful little Slovak girl from Eastern Slovakia. She's going to get mad that I said that, but they make them different in Slovakia. You know, she's not a woman in Bitcoin. She's a person in Bitcoin. She's a proper cypherpunk. And I heard about Vexel as second it came out, like when I finally realized what it was, I was like, this is what I want to do. This is the coolest thing ever. This is the ethos of Bitcoin. This is peer-to-peer. Because I was an educator, I was a teacher for, you know, a decade. I had interest in this. Once you understand Bitcoin and once you start looking at the current situation in Bitcoin and how it's grown over the last couple of years, well, they've done is hold a mirror up to our current financial like infrastructure. You know, they're establishing huge crypto banks is what they're calling them, and you know, BlackRock and ETFs and KYC hell everywhere. That is never what Bitcoin was intended to be. Bitcoin is peer-to-peer electronic cash without a third party. So all of this is happening in this industry where, you know, you have regulations and you have AML and you have KYC, and all of this establishes massive hurdles for people to obtain any sort of freedom. Because if you need permission to buy Bitcoin, then we failed. We've absolutely failed. So that's what brought me into Vexel, was just understanding the idea. So I volunteered. I worked at Trezor for 2 years volunteering for Vexel, because Vexel is a nonprofit. We will never monetize it. And I did every single thing I could to make it a success. And we are. I'm very proud to say that we just crossed 14,000 users, which is like insane for us being zero budget for marketing, nothing, you know, like. I'm fortunate to come on podcasts like this and be able to talk about it and things like that, but we're really proud of where we've gotten, and people are buying Bitcoin peer to peer with no middleman. And that's a success for me. Yeah.
How does that happen? Where's it come from? Like, what's the,
my question was, a lot of our American listeners, right? Like, they know you sign up for an account at, you know, an exchange like Swan, for example, and you give them all the information, everything you've ever done, all your addresses, your picture, your driver's license. You wait a few days, right? Like, you tell them your backstory, your biggest secrets. And then once you get approved, it's really easy. You just, you know, click a button, your bank account is debited, and you get the Bitcoin. But people who, you know, they talk about, you know, Vexel is one I've been hearing about that one a lot more lately. But before that, it was kind of like BISC, RoboSats, things like that. And you look into it, and it's a different type of user experience. It's less invasive, but I don't know, and I haven't, you know, been able to use Vexel yet, so you can talk about this, but the user experience is like not that, it's not easier, I would say. It's not, and it's like, how do you manage the payments back and forth in fiat if that's what you use? Like, what can you explain how this works? Like, what, and maybe can you compare it to the ones that people might already know about?
Yeah,
and how that flow works. And
so looking at current peer-to-peer platforms, right, is all of them for me, while they're good ideas in theory, I wouldn't touch one of them, right? They have quite a strong learning curve. You know, I hate to name drop things, but like BISC is a good example. It's a desktop application. You need Bitcoin to use BISC. So it's the chicken before the egg problem. And it's funny because what does BISC tell you to do? They say, if you want to use BISC, you don't have Bitcoin, talk to a friend or a family member that might have Bitcoin and buy it from them. Or, you know, you look at other ones, and what are the main risks of using these platforms? Well, there is a middleman most of the time, which is either escrow, which is a trust in a third party service. But the biggest risk that people don't think about is, well, it's maybe no KYC, but if I'm sending a transfer via my bank account, well, my name appears in a random person's bank account. I don't care how many 5-star ratings they have or how good their reputation is on this platform. It can be gained, but those people could become a person of interest, let's say. Maybe that person does commit a crime in Singapore. Well, the next thing you know, my name is in that person's bank account, and then my account is frozen while they do an investigation. I'm sorry, I'm out. That's not for me, right? And most platforms are that way. So with Vexel, that's the thing, right? Is most platforms use a reputation style system that is based on stars or score, and because they don't have a better way. We do. We have a better way. And that way is your social graph, right? So you talk about, well, it's inconvenient. Well, as you said, it's kind of inconvenient for me to get on Swan, because it's a huge hurdle for someone who wants to buy $100 worth of Bitcoin, right? Is you go, Jesus, I just wanted $100 worth of Bitcoin. I didn't want to give away my life story. But now that I have given away my life story, wow, it's so convenient. I'm locked into this system. The gate is open for me, and they can close it at any time. And that is a huge
And they can
risk.
Go back and say, and they can go back and say, like, you weren't breaking the law this whole time, but now we've decided that you are breaking the law and that you were breaking the law. And we have all this transaction history. And I will say that there, and you understand this, you're from the United States. There is a, like a legal, like a property defense. There's a lot of arguments that people have made. And there's a lot of reasons why Americans, you know, are a lot more, I guess, willing to put up with it. But it's not like that in the rest of the world, right? And it's definitely, I mean, in some places, it's like dangerous to even try to use it today. So, I mean, this is kind of a softball question here, but for somebody who's maybe doesn't really understand this, can you explain, like, on a more, like, specific examples or technical level, like the difference between KYC? It's like, it's not that your driver's license is uploaded to the chain right now when you buy Bitcoin from a regulated exchange, but there is, and it's also not true that you can just easily obfuscate and like clear that trail that you created once you, because a lot of people, they don't even realize what they're doing. They buy it from an exchange and it's hard to go back and erase those mistakes. So can you talk about that a little bit more?
Well, you know, when I look at KYC, is who does KYC protect? It doesn't protect anybody. It actually exposes you. Look at KYC systems, right? Look at huge exchanges. So let's call a big one Binance, right? Binance has a massive KYC operation. They have a customer support team that is around the world, and mostly remote, who have access to all of your data. Right. So you pull up a transaction and they can pull up your customer profile. They know this information about you. And this becomes a security risk because, again, it's not about the government. It's not about protecting yourself from the government or anything like this. It's about protecting yourself from individuals. Right. Is one of the, you know, it's like, what's the first rule of Bitcoin is don't tell anybody how much Bitcoin you have. And when you're buying Bitcoin, all you're on a KYC platform, you're just creating a list of this is exactly how much Bitcoin this person owns. And your name and your address, your phone number, all of this stuff is in their system. And if they know that you might seem like an easy target, they could leak that information. You know, that's a risk, right? But also KYC information is super valuable for a lot of people. This is why it winds up on the dark web constantly. You see huge leaks where your information is out there. You know, so when I look at how, you know, a lot of people look at KYC and they go, oh, it's not so bad. You know, it's to protect us at the AML, but it's not about protecting you from that. So how I look at my, you know, Bitcoin that should be no KYC is, well, Bitcoin without KYC is Bitcoin that is private. It's Bitcoin that I can do what I want with it without anyone asking me any questions whatsoever. And when I look at, you know, Bitcoin that comes from an exchange, you know, it's like, look at what they've tried to do. You know, like they put Tornado Cash guys in jail. You know, unfortunately, Wasabi had to shut down CoinJoin. You know, like these are real problems, you know, and people are trying to fix them by creating a form of privacy. But privacy is so important. And the more you give it away, the more, you know, convenience is not why you should ever give something away. It is private, your privacy, right? Because you are exposing yourself. So for me, this simple is I just don't want my information to be connected to my Bitcoin purchases that can be exploited in any way.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. I think that's a good thing to emphasize because, you know, I love, you know, I nothing against like the people who are like really outspoken about the importance of privacy and non-KYC on, you know, on places like social media. But a lot of them are paranoid libertarians who are like, they really focus on the government using like this KYC against you, which is obviously a risk. But, you know, I would argue that that's one, it's not even the top five at this point for most people. It's the bigger risk is hackers. It is people like, I mean, Ledger, if you bought a Ledger hardware wallet in the last bull market, your all your information was leaked. People could show up to your house and, you know, they didn't know how much Bitcoin you had, but they didn't care. You know, they knew you had a wallet. And it's just, there's so many attackers out there who are not federal agents or government agents who you are really putting yourself at risk, if you have, you know, your identity tied to all these transactions on chain.
Well, look at Jameson Lopp, you know, I mean, he keeps a pretty, you know, pedantic list of everyone who's been targeted. And that list grows, you know, by the day. And, you know, most of them, maybe they're not from their KYC data leaked. It's usually someone flashing on social media, hey, I got a shitload of Bitcoin, come rob me, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I think that it is a reality that when you need permission to be able to buy Bitcoin, and that's something else, the more you enable them, the more that you say and you justify and you say, oh, it's okay because, you know, these things are protecting us, the harder it's going to get to obtain Bitcoin without KYC, which is not what Bitcoin is. Bitcoin, I mean, cash, look at what they're trying to do with CBDCs in the world, right? Is they want to track every single thing that we do. They want to know, you know, if you're about to have a baby because your transactions are based around that. They want to know how you're thinking because that can, you know, sway voters. It can do so many things, and we see that. And so by having privacy is the only way to ultimately protect yourself in the world that's coming, you know, is, you know, I think I hate to reference the guy, Alex Jones, but, you know, he said 20 years ago that the future is a war for information. And the more information that we supply to people, the more risk we put ourselves in, and yep, the harder it gets to obtain your freedom. And
who would have thought that that's the battlefield that we're all, you know, playing on?
The crazy guy. Yeah. Yeah.
It's nuts.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, I think somebody made one of those crazy videos. It's like all the times that Alex Jones was right. And I mean, it's like, yeah I mean, the guy is crazy, but it's also, you know, I used to be interested in him like people were interested in Stephen Colbert. I thought it was a comedian.
Yeah. So, no, I think if you go back and watch some of the Alex Jones clips or like where he was right about something years ahead, I don't think that you could explain. I don't think like if you talked in like very professional, conventional parlance about what he was trying to talk about, I don't think that you could really, I don't think anybody would listen to you. And it's almost like somebody's speaking through
on
like some religious text. No, like a religious text where they have to use these like crazy analogies, or like they talk about the angels and the devils. Because like, how else do you explain this stuff to people who just aren't in that mindset? And that's
Alex Jones,
we talk about that stuff here, you know, like on Bitcoin podcast.
I lived in Austin, Texas, where I went to university out there, and I went to a comedy club one night to see Joe Rogan. Like, it was way before Joe Rogan's podcast. You know, like this is early days, and Alex Jones was in attendance. And after the show, I mean, like we had burned, you know, a huge joint in the parking lot, and we went into the bar, and Alex Jones is in there. And of course I'm like, all right, I've got to get a picture taken with Alex. And so I went up to him and I was like, hey, you know, I asked my friend, I was like, can you take a picture? And Alex was like, oh yeah, sure. So I put my arm around him, and my friend counted down. He said 3, 2, 1, New World Order. And when he said New World Order, Alex took his hand off from me and did a fist bump and screamed into the camera. And it is the greatest photo ever, because my face is sideways because I'm like, you know, 19 and stoned out of my ass. And Alex Jones has the Donald Trump orange glow to him that, you know, before Trump was Orange Man, Alex Jones was Orange Man. And this is, I'll have to send you the picture. It's one of the greatest.
That is
greatest photos ever.
I want to flash it on screen. That's what I wanted.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. It's a great photo. And it's like, just, you know, like, he was a comedian. He was funny to me. And then, you know, you look at it today and you know.
He's a showman. Like, he's a performer. He's a show business guy. He is. He really is. He happens to talk about,
picketing Bilderberg Group. I mean, that's like legendary.
He infiltrated the Bohemian Grove, right? And he asked like one of the guys who was on like the National Security Council or something under Clinton. He asked him to his face about the activities and like get naked at the Bohemian Grove, and the guy just, I mean, the reaction that the guy, I can't remember the guy's name, I wish I could, but he was like a very, very powerful guy. Point. And his reaction is not like, who's this crazy dude? It's like, why would
you shouldn't have been there?
You shouldn't have been there. Yeah. It's
crazy.
Yeah,
you shouldn't have been there. That place is private, you know? And it's like Nixon's on Watergate tapes calling it the, you know, I don't want to say it, but it, pretty, you know, he had some pretty strong words about what what he was saying on the Watergate
I think the thing that, you know, not to linger on Alex Jones, and I got one more privacy question before I let Mike jump in here, is the one thing that I think he was right about was just like this weird ritualistic, you know, and children are the victims. And it's this, when you get to this certain level of power, having that, these extortion, these blackmail type of situations, this dirt on people that you can leverage to get them to do things that they would never do. Even like we talk about like politicians, they're not moral people, but like even they wouldn't do some of these immoral things if it wasn't so, you know, pressing for their own, like they don't want that to get out.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at the news now. It's like Epstein, Diddy. You know, every day we're talking about this stuff. So it is weird. Yeah.
And they talk about QAnon. It's like this obsession with QAnon. It's like you don't need to uncover this crazy like Pizzagate conspiracy. It's right in front of your face. They are sacrificing children to the American Medical Association is sacrificing children to get money from the government so they can turn them. You know, sterile, you know, whatever. It's just, it's fucked up. You don't need the, it's all there. It's all there.
I mean, conspiracy theories have always been my comic books. I mean, that's like,
you know,
I was never interested in, you know, anime or comics or anything like that. But like, give me a good conspiracy theory. Give me a good rabbit hole. Like, I just like diving down them and thinking, what if it were all true? You know, like,
right.
You know, right. And then you look at like, you know, the crazy stuff of like the Vatican where they have like the giant snake and all this kind of these rooms and you go like, man, what? How? Like conspiracies are fun. They're entertainment. And, you know, when they turn out to be true, you go like, damn. Okay.
Well, yeah, we have a lot of like crazy imagery and stuff like that on our money, on the dollar. And, you know, there's some places where it's still, but like Europe, that kind of shit is like in stone. Been there for hundreds of years. Like, what like, is? Do you ever stop?
Couple blocks from my house, man. Like, there's a huge, like, a big basilica here, and the entire area surrounding is the only place in Prague where the pavement, like the sidewalks, are all checkered, black and white. And there's two huge stone columns, and on the very top of the column, there's an all-seeing eye, like the pyramid,
whoa.
And then matches up perfect with the church. And it's like, yeah, I'm geek for that kind of stuff. So like, when we walk around the city, I take tours. I'm like, you know, check out this shit. It's been here for, you know, hundreds of years.
And get stoned and walk around and see that'd be crazy.
Prague is I don't know if you guys have ever been here. Yeah. You should.
No, I gotta come.
I've been there once.
Conference out there soon. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Prague is awesome. Yeah. But yeah, back before to privacy. Sorry.
Before we get too far off, and before I let Mike rip out questions, I know he's got to ask one more thing on the privacy thing, which is, and I don't think that a lot of newer people, or you know, even not newer people, but maybe appreciate enough, is that even if you do it all right and you buy it only KYC, if you don't manage your UTXOs and your addresses correctly, right? Like, so you could have non-KYC, and if you buy something or you transact with somebody and they know who you are, or even if they don't, but like you, and you don't manage your addresses and everything correctly, they can see exactly how much Bitcoin you have. And can you talk about what I'm talking about right now and like why that's like, important?
Like I had a friend recently, he wrote me, you know, like 2 weeks ago, he's buying Bitcoin, and he says, hey, is it bad to use the same address every time that I buy Bitcoin? And I was like, well, if you do that, if you buy Bitcoin from me, for example, and you put all of it in there, then I'll know exactly how much you have, right? Is Bitcoin the block, you know, it's the ledger, it's public. So if I know your address, I know everything about you. And a lot of people, you know, and this is another good example. They buy from an exchange, they set up their withdrawal, they use the same address every single time they withdraw, right? And this is a terrible habit, a really bad one. UTXO management is really important. You know, it's something that, like, if you don't know how to manage your UTXOs, it's something that you should do. If you have a hardware wallet like Trezor, they definitely make it easier with coin control and these kind of things that are built in the app. But, you know, using the same address over, no, you should use a fresh address every single time. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I think Lightning has been such a revelation. I think Lightning is used a lot more in Europe maybe than it is in America. You know, it's like I spend Lightning on a daily basis in Prague. which is also great when you're, you know, buying Bitcoin peer-to-peer and you meet somebody and your transaction is instantaneous. And it does give me a little bit of privacy in that way, is because I'm definitely going to be using a different address every single time.
And for people who don't know, if you can use a different address every single time and not have to memorize 12 more words, right? Like, that's an obvious thing, but like, I think a lot of people.
Well, if you're not using
a reminder.
If you're not using a wallet that generates a new address every time you hit the receive button, then change your wallet. That's just bad UX and it's not a good idea. Yeah. But, you know, something that we, you know, I kind of didn't touch on previously is when you asked me about the difference between us and other platforms. And
yeah, I wanted to get into that, yeah.
The convenience of, you know, we say, oh, well, it's inconvenient to maybe buy Bitcoin peer-to-peer. Well, I don't believe that. I think that Vexel has solved this issue, is that I'm not buying Bitcoin from an institution. I'm not buying it from a corporation.
But what if you don't know anybody that has Bitcoin that you can buy it from? I mean, that's kind of a crazy thing to say today, but there's, you know, somebody out there who doesn't, their aunts, uncles, friends.
Yeah.
Are you integrated with Nostr or Nostr? Can they do it off? Can they create a social graph? Okay.
But what is your social graph, right? Like, so who do you know? I, you know, if I know Dan, right, and you know, like, Michael? Is Michael?
It's Michael or Mike, whatever.
Mike, okay, yeah. And you know Michael, right? I don't know Mike. Exactly, right? I know Dan, but I don't know Mike. But I don't know what happened. My camera just went weird. Okay. But the way that would kind of work is I can trade with Mike because I know Dan. I don't need to trust Mike because Dan trusts Mike. And I know Dan well, and we go back. So the way that we see how that builds is that it scales over time, right? So maybe when you first download Vexel, you don't have a lot of people. But if you know me and me alone, your network is going to grow by 300 people instantly, right? Mm-hmm. So if you only have a couple of friends right now that are Bitcoiners, well, the beauty of Vexel is it's not just connecting you with other Bitcoiners. It's using your social graph, right? So if Mike and I have the same dog walker, if she's not a Bitcoiner, but we know that we both know the same dog walker. So I don't know who Mike is, but we share the dog walker. So I might say, hey, I'm happy to trade with you, but you know, can I ask the dog walker if you're cool? Because you're my only connection. But as it starts to scale, you don't have just one connection. You have 25. You know, like now when I do a peer-to-peer trade, I usually look for offers that I have 20 or more mutual friends with. This is not happening. Vexel is very local as well. So I do all of my trades with cash. I meet you under the statue at 3:00 and I give you cash and you give me Bitcoin and I walk away. Is this inconvenient? No, because you go out every single day of your life. You go to the supermarket, you go to the ATM, you go everywhere. When it's local, it becomes meeting a friend for coffee. And if anything, it makes us more social and more active and better to get out and talk to other Bitcoiners and continue to use the thing, right? When you lose that human connection, you also stop caring. If the other person is, if you're in America and I'm in Australia and you want to screw me over online, it doesn't affect you, right? But if Mike screws me over, you damn well better know I am telling Dan. Because he's our mutual friend, and Dan is gonna, his trust in Mike is hurt because of that. And so you have every single incentive to behave as a good person on the app because you want this. I know I want it. I want to be able to buy Bitcoin peer-to-peer with cash. But Vexel grew into so much more than that. You know, in Czech Republic, the first month we launched, you know, we had a couple thousand users, which was unbelievable. And then farmers started saying, hey, I got eggs and honey, and I'm going to sell this for Bitcoin on Vexel, right? Which is amazing because they listed their honey and people started buying honey for Bitcoin. Now we have a marketplace.
Now we have BitAxes yet?
I actually have a Bitminer for sale right here. I'm not selling my BitAx. I love my BitAx. And plus, it's going to be me. I'm going to find them.
I'm waiting. Every time I see that BitAx founded, I immediately check my wallet. I'm like, oh my God, is it me?
I've got two Brains mini miners over here, and I need to sell one of them. I have the original one. I want to sell it. But mine's for sale on Vexel, right? But like, I saw like a horse for sale. A farmer was selling a horse. And the craziest one for me is someone was selling, they went to Croatia, they went fishing and they caught some octopus and they put the octopus on Vexel. And wow. I was like, this has to be a joke. Like this has to be a joke. Not even 2 days later, there's a guy holding an octopus in his backyard, throwing it on the grill and saying, you'll never believe what I bought for Bitcoin. And then, we're in Africa and these places, and like people are selling pickled vegetables in Botswana on Vexel. This is so much more than just buying and selling Bitcoin. This is a true circular economy app. If you want to find a job and you want to work in Bitcoin, say it. You got Bitcoin friends and you got a friend that wants to work in Bitcoin, we're going to help you. We're friends. I trust you. And that's how you build something. You don't fake it with ratings. You don't do this. You build something that is valuable because you're putting your trust in who you know. And the more people I have in common with you, the better it is, the stronger that trusted network comes and the larger it scales. When you look at other options for having to buy Bitcoin, right? It's like group chats, Facebook groups, and these kinds of things. And that shit is all public. It is a disaster to moderate. People are going to DM you, trying to scam you constantly. This does not scale. We have a better option now, and we do that. So there's no fiat on ramp. Vexel does not have a wallet. It does not touch Bitcoin. It does not touch fiat. All we like to joke that we're Tinder for peer-to-peer, is I want you to meet the person that every time you want to buy Bitcoin, you just send him a message on Signal. You don't need Vexel. I want you to meet your forever.
Okay, so somebody, if somebody, whether it's a private individual or a government agent, if they get a hold of your Vexel, your phone, or whatever, they can't go in there and see your transaction history. They can see you're communicating with somebody, but they can't prove that you've got this much Bitcoin from this person.
There is zero record of anything. So all of the information is separated. Your profile is completely separated from your phone numbers, your contacts, your messages, your offers. Each offer is encrypted for each person individually. It is not a public marketplace. It is a your network marketplace. So I only see what's in my network. So, and when I finish a trade, what do? I immediately say, thank you. I close the chat. It's gone forever. Right? There is no transactions. There is no history. Everything happens off the app. The only thing the app does is say, these two people might be interested in communicating with each other. So that's what it does. Yes, you can chat through Vexel. You can open, there's a trade checklist so you can agree to everything before, but that is fully encrypted between you two. Everything happens once you meet and you can decide. Now, do you have to meet face-to-face? No, that is entirely up to you, because if you trust the person and it's you have 40 friends in common, and you go, hey man, it's raining and I don't feel like getting out. Would you mind if I sent you some money via bank or, Revolut or whatever? And that would, that's up to you, entirely up to you. So we are a nonprofit. We do not have a way to take fees. We survive on donations only. We are not a middleman. See your trades.
Has this been an effective way for like Europeans especially to avoid like being debanked by trying to buy Bitcoin from some, offshore company or whatever? They just violate, they're too risky. It's like you're just sending a friend a couple bucks, right? Like you're not buying $1,000, here and there.
Yeah, I mean, Look, I think most of the transactions are happening face to face. I mean, that's what is the craziest thing for me is when you look at other platforms, they have this option. Oh yeah, you can be paid, but no one's ever doing that. With Vexel, most of the people are meeting face to face. So you're trading for cash. And once you do it once, you want to do it again. I promise you. It's like it becomes like, oh, hell yeah. It's such a good feeling to go buy Bitcoin with cash. But when it comes to like just doing it, it's not even that. It's like the unbanked. You look at where we've had some big success, and that is countries like Africa as well. And I mean, like countries in Africa, like Kenya, Nigeria, Namibia, because these people, they've never had bank accounts. You know, look at some of the stuff that like, I think Frank Korva, if you're familiar with him, what he's covered with Bitcoin Dada, which is like the women in Africa who were never allowed to have bank accounts. Bitcoin gave them that option, and peer-to-peer for cash also gives them freedom and empowers them. You know, we take it for granted. We live in the Western countries. You know, we live in Europe. We live in America, where we take everything for granted when it comes to that. Most Americans still think the FDIC is insuring all of the money in their bank account, right? So we've never, you know, we haven't experienced much of that in our personal lives. But when you talk to people who live in places where they are unbanked, it's a big difference. You know, and look at our third largest area is Canada. Canada Vexel is growing like crazy. They have a huge Vexel community in Vancouver. You know, in Toronto, it's growing. You know, these people also, Canadians are, they've had some experience with some being unbanked and accounts frozen for reasons and protests and things as well. So yeah, it is absolutely an option for people.
So it sounds like a social media app specifically, but if I sign on to this thing, how do I even find anyone? Like, do I have to actually go physically out into the world and find another Vexel user or create another Vexel user?
No. So the way Vexel
it's KYC, but it's know your contact list. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
Yeah, well, the way Vexel works is, well, what is the oldest web of trust in existence? All right. Is phone numbers. The only other solid webs of trust out there that are really good is Facebook, right? Is I have like kids I went to elementary school with on Facebook, like Jenny, who I remember from kindergarten, a photo is my friend on Facebook. Do I really know her? No, but we all know, we have 77 mutual friends, right? That is a web of trust. It shows how things are built, and phone numbers are a way to build a web of trust privately. Your phone numbers are not shared with us. They are not shared with the server. Nothing. Every single part of Vexel happens on your device. So the numbers, your contacts are hashed, and the hashes are what build out your social graph. So if Mike and I both have Dan's number, we will share the hash, not the phone number. It will happen on my device. I will see that hash leads to Dan in my phone book. So it's however I have Dan stored in my address book is what the hash is going to tell me, right? So we compare hashes, not phone numbers. Everything is private. And even if, you know, like let's say that someone were to get all the hashes and dehash them and get phone numbers from them, which would be a very difficult thing, but technically it is possible, they receive nothing. They get a list of phone numbers that are in no way connected to Bitcoin, no way connected to chats, trades, anything, because it's my dog walker, it's my pizza company, it's my doctor. These are numbers that are of no value. So I can randomly generate numbers on AI using ChatGPT and say, I need phone numbers for the Denver, Colorado area, and it will give me, boom, a list of the numbers of that are super valuable. So we've thought about all of the ways to be private. You know, with anything is you have to figure out, and those people will come after us. They will say, yeah, you want my phone number. And I go, no, I don't. But your phone number is the secret to building the most powerful web of trust that you've ever had. Nostr is a possibility down the road. Nostr currently has about 25,000 active users. So the web of trust is being built. And, you know, we are now six people and a dog. So we don't have the resources to kind of think about, well, we need to implement an Ulster right now. That's the thing, because my grandmother, my dad, my uncle, these people do not use an Ulster, and they probably won't for a long time. I want to make Bitcoin accessible for my aunt, my uncle.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
And that's the quickest way to do it. Is my uncle could jump on Vexel and he would immediately have a massive network of people to trade with because he knows me. And the same would go for both of you if we were available in America.
Nice.
When America?
When America? Yeah, that's the question.
So that leads me to my final question is, as a, you know, or would you consider yourself an expat at this point, or?
It's weird because, of course, I'm an expat, but at some point, you know, you think, well, am I an expat or an immigrant?
Yeah, right. Okay. But yeah, either way, as you know, what is your perspective from as an immigrant or an expat who's been kind of outside the United States for over a decade? Just what is your perspective on what's happening, particularly around Bitcoin? Like it has gone from, you know, something that they wanted nothing to do with, they called it a scam, and now it is like one of the centerpieces of the first, you know, 2 months in office for Donald Trump. And it's just, it's everywhere. It's all the politicians are talking about it. How do you view that?
Man, that's a tough one, right? Because, you know, there was a point, you know, it's like, I mean, how can I say it? I don't trust the government. I don't like the government getting involved in anything. And when I have like such a polarizing figure as Donald Trump is championing, you know, what really put it all together for me is, you know, the election season was really fascinating because it was something unprecedented for us. We had a dramatic change in candidates, you know, a couple months before the election. But what really put it all in perspective was how ridiculous it is to try to even think about courting politicians is when Donald Trump spoke at Bitcoin in Nashville or whatever. And the speech, whatever, but the very last thing he said when he walked off stage, I'm sure you remember what he said.
Have fun playing with your Bitcoins.
Have fun playing with your Bitcoins, which told me everything I needed to know about Donald Trump and his position on Bitcoins, because it's the same shit my dad was saying to me, or my uncle was saying to me, or all of the people who doubted me for years were telling me to have fun playing with your Bitcoins. How's your Bitcoins doing there, buddy? You know, and we've all seen that meme of the guy standing in the attic coming down from Thanksgiving going, how's your Bitcoins doing, buddy? And that have fun playing with your Bitcoin, you know, is a joke. And then you see what he's actually signing the executive order and he's looking off and going, did I promise to do this? Did I promise? Is this what I was supposed to do?
This will be a good thing, right?
Yeah, it's going to be good. And then, you know, Trump coin launching, what, the 24 hours before he took office, which is like, I mean, probably one of the most illegal things you could probably do as president of the United States is to launch a shitcoin meme coin 24 hours before you become president and then basically rug pull people. So I look at the state of America and I go, yeah, you're going through your shitcoining phase. You're going through, you know, is you've got some loud conservative voices. The majority of them are on the right, let's say.
Yeah.
And when you look at the difference between something like X and Blue Sky. I downloaded Blue Sky just because I was curious what it looked like on there. And all you need to do is log in and you can see it's just hatred for everything that's Bitcoin, hatred for everything that's the current political system. America
right.
is a
We're attaching
is a
ourselves
keg.
To a very toxic movement to, you know, half the world or more. And there's consequences to that. And I think my kind of take on it is that, you know, at a certain point, the United States or just sovereign states were going to somehow get into, I don't know how they, I don't know if they're going to sign a strategic Bitcoin reserve. They were going to get involved and they are involved now. Mm-hmm. And they're learning how to use it and they're being interested in it and they're seeing value in it. And Michael Saylor, he talks about inflation as a vector.
And he's like, you can't look at the CPI and say that inflation is this many percent. You have to look at your cost basis, like for where you live, how much it costs for shelter, food, et cetera. And that's how you calculate your own inflation. And I think that privacy is also a vector, because privacy is not like it's a very hard thing to define and like what it means to Bitcoin. I think if you ask everybody, they'd have a different explanation. And there's a lot of people, especially who probably listen to the show, who they probably, especially if you're American, you probably already got Bitcoin from Coinbase, Swan, River, all these different places, your KYC'd. And that doesn't mean that you just keep going down that that path. It also doesn't mean necessarily, it might actually be a worse strategy to like dump it all and then start going like non-KYC only, like, because you're just like, that's very suspicious. Like if you think of privacy as a vector, it's like, especially like I work for Swan, I work for a Bitcoin company. If I just didn't have Bitcoin, like that would seem maybe suspicious. And you can manage, you can decide what, if you need to buy $1 million of Bitcoin or $10,000 of Bitcoin, well, you're probably not going to be able to do it on BISC or Vexel.
No.
And you can decide, like, you can segregate and decide what to reveal to the state, what not to reveal. You can decide what to, and that's the beauty of Bitcoin. You can decide the privacy that you need. You can decide what you reveal. You can decide how to express yourself on chain. It doesn't have to be a uniform strategy.
Yeah, I mean, my whole thing is be a good person, do good, right? So it's not about obscuring or hiding anything from anyone. You know, that's how I feel, right? When I look at who, you know, like look at a platform, are you a police agent? Are you paid to police people? No. You're paid to, you know, you're trying to create something that makes things better for everyone. I do good, right? I'm not a police officer. So it's not my responsibility to ensure that you are a good person. It's my responsibility to ensure that I'm a good person. So when it comes to disclosing how much, you know, you have when it comes to taxes or anything, pay your taxes, do good, follow the laws so that you don't do bad and that you don't get in trouble and you don't put yourself at risk, right? But when I look at where is the risk? Well, if I were to, you know, create a platform where I'm gathering people's personal data, I don't feel comfortable owning anyone else's data, right? It's like, I then because I become responsible for your private information, and that I'm not cool with that. I don't want all of your data on one of my servers so that it could become attack vector for someone, right?
Yeah, and being a for-profit company versus, you know, a not-for-profit, that changes the incentive structure completely. Because if you are trying to build profit from your platform, you are most likely going to have to, I mean, the data is valuable. I mean, you want that data. The state's going to make you have that data in most cases.
Look at Avast, right? I mean, Avast was an antivirus company that was there to help protect you. And what were they doing the entire time was just farming your data and selling it to the highest bidder. You know, this is another reason why we look at okay, is it open source? Can I verify that what is they're saying they're doing is 100% what they're doing, right? And that was what really resonated with me with starting into Trezor and the starting in Satoshi Labs, is that the foundation of the company was that we have to do everything as transparent and as clear as possible so that the people that are interacting with your software, they don't have to trust you, they can verify. And we are very familiar, every single one of us as Bitcoiners, we're familiar with this expression, don't trust, verify. And that's what open source does, is because not only does open source allow you to verify, but it allows you to say, hey, this is a cool project. I think I can improve it. I think I can make it better. And if you do, mission accomplished. That's the beauty, is we're trying to build something that is censorship resistant, that is totalitarian resistant, that is can survive, that can enable people to have the freedom to transact without needing permission. And while I understand, you know, my going home, I went home like a year ago, and you know, my parents are okay, coming around, they're interested. Okay, let's talk more about this Bitcoin thing. And they ask me, well, how do I buy Bitcoin? And that's like such a difficult question to answer based on where you live. If you live in America, 99 or 100% of the ways to buy Bitcoin are usually going to be recommended. Here's my referral link, man. Click on this, sign up, give away all your personal information, and then wait a couple days and you'll get permission and then you can buy Bitcoin, right? And if you're in Europe, similar things are going on. But now we have a better way. And if we don't build these tools and if we don't resist against KYC infrastructure, you know, I made a meme. I was in Madeira last year for the conference, and Michael Saylor gave his talk, and it was, you know, he mentioned peer-to-peer. And I made a meme of like, yeah, I can't imagine Michael Saylor standing in a parking garage at, you know, 4 in the afternoon with briefcases with, you know, $1 billion in it saying, can we do this cash for Bitcoin? You know, it's like, yeah, I understand that is, but that's another reason why, you know, Bitcoin, the very first line, it says it's peer-to-peer electronic cash, right? The way I transact with Bitcoin is very different than the way a lot of people in America view Bitcoin. And I think this is a thing is in America, Bitcoin is viewed more as a savings and investments type thing. Whereas someone like me, I spend Bitcoin on a daily basis. I live in a country where we have Quirko, which is there's a QR code on every single table in any pub or restaurant where one of the options is Bitcoin Lightning. So I go to conferences, I spend Bitcoin, right? And I enjoy doing it. So the infrastructure that you've built or that they've built in America is one teaching you that Bitcoin isn't money. Bitcoin is gold. And that's just simply incorrect, how I view Bitcoin. Of course, you can use it as a hedge against inflation, or you can treat it like gold. But Bitcoin is money. Bitcoin is electronic cash without a middleman. So the fact that America has basically set it up that you can't buy Bitcoin without a middleman means that it's a failure in that regard for me. And we have to protect that.
Yep. And so, even if you're listening to this and you're thinking, well, this P2P stuff sounds difficult, especially when it comes to like buying in size, it's like, well, one thing's for sure is that almost every big exchange, US or not, and definitely the ETFs, they use your data. They're trading against you. They're basically, they see what the customer data is doing, and they are trading against you. They are shorting what you're longing. They're longing what you're shorting, whatever. It's an adversarial environment out
relationship
there, regardless. Well, relationship. Yeah, it's for sure. And but Grafton, go ahead.
I have mad respect for all companies in Bitcoin. You know, it's like I look at it and, you know, it's funny. It's easy to make fun of clown base. I mean, they really sold their souls, right? But Coinbase did provide such a great service in the beginning for so many people, right?
Yeah, it's not black and white.
2020 being locked up with Clubhouse and all of the work that Swan did for education for the masses. Swan educated probably more people in 2020 on Bitcoin than most other institutions out there. You know, like, you know, now, you know, you look at these and how it's going, it's like I have mad respect for companies like Relay in Europe, because I understand, and they are trying to solve the same problem. They're trying to make Bitcoin as convenient as possible, but they have regulators and they have people that have their hands around their throat saying comply. So, you know, I also do get why we have to tie in Bitcoin with politics, is because, you know, you look at America and that is the case. All of these, Phoenix left, Wallace Satoshi left America, all of these places, they said, no, we're not doing business there. So it really does come down to you going and talking to your politicians or lobbying or running for office and saying, hey, we do need to do things better. And I am not a politician. There's not a politician out there that I would put my, you know, endorsement behind. Like, there's not. But, you know, I think that is why America is in the position that it's in right now, and why they're pushing so hard for this is because I think they do realize that a lot of companies are just choosing not to participate in the American system because it's not like it is anywhere else. And that's like why I think, look at how Bitcoin is in America, is you're basically, people are afraid to buy peer-to-peer because they're worried that they might get in trouble for something. And that's,
yeah, they don't want to use mixers, coin joins, things like that for just reasons that they might.
Privacy is criminalized.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey man, thank you so much for coming on today. I don't know if you want to let people know where they can find you, where they can learn more about Vexel. We will have your phone number in the show notes so people can connect to that Web of Trust. I'm kidding.
Please don't.
I'm kidding. But all the other information that you would like to share.
Yeah.
It's because, like you said, it's a choice.
Yeah. I mean, I am. I work for a company that advocates privacy in every regard, but I am extremely doxed individual on the internet. But I am Sats Disco, like everywhere. Noster, I'm Sats Disco. Twitter, whatever you call it these days. Sats Disco. You can find me there. Please, like, check us out, Vexel. Because we really are building something special. As I said before, we're a nonprofit, so we only survive on donations. We're very happy to have the support of the Human Rights Foundation and OpenStats so far, who have helped fund us. So if you're interested in really helping us out and checking out what we are doing and what our mission is, please check out our foundation, which is Vexel.foundation, where we have a really cool metric there called the Financial Tyranny Index, which allows you to see like the current CBDC status of the world, daily cash transaction limits. You can kind of gauge where your country ranks in the world of financial tyranny. So it's a pretty interesting metric. So check that out, please. And yeah, that's it. I really appreciate you guys having me on. Thanks for adjusting to my time schedule, because the other one was like, it was like 3 or 4 in the morning or something. And like, I wouldn't be as sharp, but yeah, it's been good. Thanks. Really. Thank you guys. It's been fun.
Thank you, Grimson.
Yeah. Stay in touch. We'll let you know when, I got to make it out to Prague for the conference. I got to get out there for a lot of reasons, but yeah.
Yeah, the conference this year is going to be another big one. But if you're in Prague, like, yeah, look me up, man, for sure. I'll show you guys a good time. I'll take you for some proper beef. And yeah, I'll have a good time.
Awesome.
Cool.
Thank you again for listening to the High Hash Rate Podcast with Dan and Mike. If you want to learn more about the podcast and see what we're up to, you can find us at highhashrate.com. Or if you just want to speak to a couple of baked ADIQ plebs, reach out to us at hello@highhashrate.com. Or you can reach out to us at the High Hash Rate handle on X. Later, everybody.
Holy Toledo!